Jerry Pippen, and we're talking from Angel Fire, not far from Dulce, and that's the subject, an underground base, and if it's there, why and who's there? Is there an extraterrestrial connection? An intriguing program here with Dennis Balthizer, Norio Hayakawa, and Anthony Sanchez. Yes. Anthony, I think what we'll do is visit a little bit more about it, turn it over to the audience, ask some questions. You guys, all three of you, can jump in and talk among yourselves as well. And then at the end, if we left something out, you can fill it in.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sounds okay to me. First of all, you have a quote. What's your name?
Alex.
Okay. Where are you from?
Taos.
Okay. Your question.
I just wanted to see, Anthony, what you thought your next step would be in terms of either corroborating the story with another individual from the military, or what, if not that, then what your next step would be as far as validating that?
Two things, actually. I'm actually heading out to Dulce with Norio
after
the conference.
Now, I knew that, but I didn't know whether I should mention that. I'm glad you say it's okay.
Yeah, we're going to be heading out to Dulce. We're going to be trying to find some evidence of some of the information that was provided to me by the colonel. I did ask for coordinates, and I had some coordinates provided and others where he would not provide it simply because of safety reasons. And but the other point that I'd like to make is when this book hits the shelves and it gets out there, my hope is that I'm going to get contacted by ex-military personnel, people who have worked at the facility as part of the scientific contingent, whether they were an engineer, whether they were a research geneticist or whatever, who could come forth and say, yes, I did work there. TAD-1 does exist. There is a 7-level underground facility. There are no reptilians. There are grays there. Grays that we found in 1940. And that's an interesting part of this story. One of the points of contestation for me. I fought hard with the colonel and pressured him with questions because, again, that was a point of unbelievability for me at first. I could not accept that. But what he said was, is what they found deeper in the caverns were machines. Remember, this is 1940. There are no laptops. There are no personal recording devices, no cell phones. In those days, you had designated personnel within your unit that would keep journals. Again, these are the journals that the colonel read as part of the briefing documents and later when he remained there employed as part of DSD-3, which is the intelligence agency there at Dulce. They found what they described as cryptography machines, large radar screens, large flat radar screens. First they thought there were windows into other rooms, but then they realized that they were, you know, recessed into the caverns, the walls of the caverns. Near each screen they found personnel type stations. They found a writing system. This is what is really interesting to me, which gives it a human connection. The writing system was an Akkadian cuneiform-like writing system, and except that it had a much more defined structure, much more highly evolved, and much more precision-like appearance than what we found in southern Iraq, where the oldest civilization known to man, the Sumerians of ancient Sumer, had used cuneiform. Akkadian, you have your Akkadian and you have your Ugaritic alphabetic cuneiform type structures found on the cylinder seals and tablets, these clay tablets. So there's a connection which was of interest to me, which gave it kind of a human element. So the military, were able to translate this language. And supposedly, we understand why these grays that they discovered, the inhabitants as they referred to them, were there and have been there. Essentially, they were placed there to die. They wanted them to go away, is what the story was. And there were two groups of these inhabitants.
Let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
In other words, through some sort of development, you had the Greys, and they didn't need them anymore, right?
That is correct. There was a progenitor race of beings, according to the writings that they discovered. Now, they discovered thousands of these metallic sheets. The soldiers called them metallic sheets, and they had this writing system which was created with a machine-like precision. So when the experts came in, they called them tablets because of the Akkadian cuneiform style of writing system. They decided to begin calling them tablets. It made more sense to them, I guess, because of the tablets they had found in ancient Iraq.
Now, these tablets weren't carved writings or anything like that. It's more like an iPad of today.
So they're more of like an etching into it of a metallic, thin metallic type sheets. So,
how long do you figure they were there?
Well, according to what they were able to,
how far back, yeah.
Well, according to the writings, these Greys have been there for 25,000 years. And they maintain their numbers to a small population of about 1,000. Now, they have no human genetic components. There's no genetic relation to humans. Now, this is the interesting part of the story. There was a progenitor race that supposedly came into our star system about 250,000 years ago. Now, this is what the colonel told me that was in these writings. And by the way, all of these metallic metal sheets, these tablets, are at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, sealed away forever. And the last person to have looked at them was an Assyrian scientist. And I have the name of the scientist. It's in the book. It was provided to me by the colonel. And I did my research, and it corroborates to just before the time this person retired from, he was a mathematical specialist in Akkadian cuneiform. So I can get into that later, but there was a progenitor race that came to Mars. They created bases on the moon. And some type of catastrophic event occurred on Mars. They had to abandon Mars for Earth. When they came to Earth, this progenitor race began to die off. They had some type of genetic predisposition which the Earth's environment was just killing them off slowly. They viewed early hominid as something they didn't want anything to be a part. They didn't want any part of early hominid, which I guess was us. So they created this...
Well, you can't blame them for that.
So they created this group called the Aloha. And the Aloha were what we know commonly as the Greys. So the Greys were to serve as a sort of a liaison type caste, intermediaries, demigods for the humans, the early hominids who they were going to use as a servant caste. And again, these Astra Albis is what the writings called the progenitor race, the Astra Albis. And the Astra Albis, again, created a generation of offspring. So actually, the progenitor race didn't have a name. And they created this first generation of offspring called the Astra Albis. The Astra Albis, like the progenitor race, wanted nothing to do with the hominids. However, when the progenitor race died away, when they died off, the Astra Albis, these genetically enhanced beings, had the same genetic predisposition as their forebears, and they began to die off, and they had to make a choice: genetic hybridization with hominid to sustain their lineage. And that's what they did. And supposedly, we are the offspring of these.
Now, Norio and Dennis, if we accept the story that they've been in this underground area, the first thing I think about is, why would they be underground? Now, Anthony has the answer. But do you guys have any idea why they inhabit these subterranean bases?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that many of the Native American people in the United States have this rich cultural and spiritual beliefs, and their beliefs in what we call as paranormal type events, and their belief that their ancestors actually came from below. And, you know, this type of concept and belief is essential and conveniently coincided with this possible scenario. And that's my take on this whole thing. And I'm not an expert on any grays or anything like that. I don't even know about this, except that I think it's a fact that the government is interested in what's below. And there's no question about it.
Dennis, We one of the things when you investigate Dulce is that area, the Native American tribe there is very protective of all of their legends.
Yeah, what Norio just said, the Hopi Indians out in Arizona claim to have come out from within the earth out at Flagstaff, Arizona. The reason today that we're doing things underground, it's a simple fact that there are satellites going over the earth that can read a newspaper from 200 miles up. You can't do anything secretly above ground anymore. It either has to be done in an enclosure, a hangar, or underground. Thus, Area 51, different places. And that makes sense. And we're not the only country that does that. All countries do it because we have satellites too. As far as out of Dulce, what was your question? How did you ask that?
Well, basically, I just wanted to know why you know, the Native legends, gets confusing. You met Bigfoot up there.
Well,
so you start talking to people about U.S. government intervention, and maybe even the cattle mutilations might be biological. I mean, there's all kinds of... But I'm personally of the opinion it's all of the above.
Well, you know, the Native Americans have a tremendous amount of knowledge about the star system. They talk about the Seven Sisters and different things like that. And I have a lot of respect for the Native Americans because of that. In fact, I have a couple of websites, links on my website to Native Americans. And I asked a Native American a couple of years ago, I said, why don't you all talk about this? And his answer was, nobody's asked, which I thought was a great answer. But, you know, they, up at Dulce, when Norio had the conference, I really got the impression that what they see, what they being the Native Americans, if they see something in the sky, I think they think that's personally for them. And they don't really want to share that with the public. And they're very private people, and I respect that. And I think that somehow, if we can get some knowledge out of the Native American, I think we'll make headways with a lot of things.
Yeah, I read all 53 of the sacred texts of the Jicarilla Apache Nation when I started to question the validity of the story of these beings living beneath the Mesa Plateau, because it just doesn't sound right. You know, it's just like, how could somebody be underneath the plateau for 25,000 years, so technologically advanced, and not leave? Why can't they come to the surface? So I did all my research, and it is so interesting that so many of the Native American cultures in the Four Corner areas, they have these sacred texts. They do what is called storytelling. The elders will perform storytelling, and there are so many clues there. One of the stories that I found of interest was the legend of the Ant People. And when they did their translations in the 1940s of these metal sheets, the names of the inhabitants translated into English were equivalent of, well, the first one, Aloha, they don't know what that means. The second one, Formidike, means ant. Formidike means ant. Isn't that strange? So
now we need to tell them why the grays are down there.
Well,
there's a biological reason.
There's a definite biological reason. They had a set of genetic predispositions that prevents them from surfacing. They have a magnetic type quality of their outer epidermis, and the electromagnetic radiation from the sun can literally kill them and cause tumors, cancerous-like tumors, and they have no answer to that. And this was actually, now according to the writings, this was actually designed by the as some type of like a disease or something, or some type of a genetic defect, purposely created so that they would die off.
Yeah, Norio, you have something to
yeah.
add?
Yeah, this gentleman...
Have you jump in anytime?
Yeah, sure. This gentleman came up with this question. If there's such an underground base, in order to create an underground base, this gentleman came up with this question, it's impossible for the public not to notice the construction machinery and so on, and it'll take tremendous technology but the thing is this. Did you know that there's a hotel, Greenbrier Hotel in Virginia or somewhere,
yeah.
That they people were staying in that hotel every day, but they had no idea that an underground seven-level facility was being built.
That was for Congress.
That was for Congress.
Right.
And so it's possible, it's not impossible for the government to conduct construction programs where nobody can even see. So that's, I would say that is the probably the answer that answers your question. It's possible to conduct underground construction without any superficial even evidence for anything going on.
Now, Dennis Balthizer, you're pretty up on underground bases.
Yeah, I want to get in on this one. What the gentleman probably doesn't realize is that in 1973 at Los Alamos National Lab, there was a underground tunnel boring machine invented that is a nuclear device. This thing goes through the earth and digs a hole, and it takes the rock and dirt that it gets out in a magma state, in a molten state, and pushes it into the wall of the hole it just made, makes a glass-like lining as it's going through the earth, and never is anything brought out of the ground or anything taken in. Under the old methods of boring, you have to have a conveyor belt that has carts, and they bring the stuff out, and you see a big mound of dirt. Or they take wood in, or they take concrete in, or steel to shore it up. With their nuclear machine, which can go through the earth at about 3 to 5 feet an hour, it requires nothing above ground. They could be drilling under us at this moment, and we wouldn't know it. They could be 1,000 feet down there, so... is not beyond doing this, and this was invented in 1973. I have no idea what they have today.
And some of the research that I did, when they were digging tunnels, when they were boring tunnels under the Los Alamos Township, some of the outer-lying areas, people were hearing these hums, low-frequency hums.
The Apollo's hum was pretty famous.
Yes. So, I mean, there's a definite corroboration there.
I have heard that the Taos hum is no longer. But I've also heard, within the last year, I've also heard from some people at Eagle Nest, just 9 miles away, I've heard that Eagle Nest is starting to hear a hum.
That's right.
If that's the case, there may be something moving through the ground underneath us here.
We have Anthony Sanchez, we have Norio Hayakawa, and Dennis Balthizer. And this lady, what's your name?
Sandra.
And where are you from?
Los Angeles.
Okay, do you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to know if anybody here remembers the Ray Palmer, Richard Shaver stories about the Darrows, these degenerative creatures who live under the earth, and they have the machines left over from ancient people. And it's the same thing he's talking about there. It sounds like he's got more detail on it.
Have you heard about that, Anthony?
I'm sorry, I didn't get most of that.
Okay, their names again were...
Ray Palmer... Fate Magazine, founder of Fate Magazine, and Richard Shaver. There was a lot of stuff back in the 40s about the Darrows, D-E-R-O-S, little creatures who are, degenerated.
I think they called them old men at one time.
I don't know, but they had access to these machines that were very ancient, and they lived in the tunnels, and they did bad things to us.
No, but sounds a lot like what... what I uncovered in my research through my interview with the colonel, one of the things I learned was is that in 1956, there was a human mutilation that had occurred over in the White Sands area, and they had evidence proving that it was, in fact, the Greys, who had already struck an accord with DST-3 as part of the Dulce facility, where they were not supposed to do that. The accord had specifically stated that they were only allowed to perform abductions of cattle and lesser mammal forms, and they violated that because of the small numbers of personnel, and they took advantage of the personnel of DST-3. And that was the point when the colonel told me that DST-3 had augmented their numbers to about 70. They also brought in tactical specialists.
Didn't you tell me at one time it was 20 or 22 or something like that?
Yeah, it was like the number was at around 20.
Yeah.
And
so they went three times at least.
That's right. And they brought in tactical specialists, and they essentially righted that wrong. And I don't think there was any human mutilations occurring again after that point.
But, Dennis, you've got to go back and do your job.
I do.
I'm seeing things.
Another speaker coming up here, one of 13 we've had this weekend.
You got any closing thoughts?
No,
I appreciate you taking time out. You missed lunch.
That's all right. I probably do without. I'm just glad to see that the Dulce thing is becoming active again. It's been around for many years. The rumors of biogenetics taking place there and things. So I'm glad that Anthony and Nori are continuing to do this. I hope I can stay involved with it also. And I really look forward to the book coming out. I want to read that and see what he's got.
Yeah, Anthony, the name of the book again is?
UFO Highway. And you can find information about the book at UFOHighway.com.
And we have a link to that. Nori, y'all? How long have you known Anthony?
Yes, he contacted me.
No, he searched you out.
Yes, that's right. He searched me out. And
what was your initial thought?
I was flabbergasted. I was so shocked at this Anthony's successful interview with this colonel, Air Force colonel. And this, as I said, brings a new chapter in the ongoing investigations of the claims of the underground base in Dulce. It brings to a new level, and I'm so excited we'll be going to the Dulce area again. In fact, I was there myself in Dulce 10 days ago, just check out the general makeup of the city. And of course, I was still impressed by the presence of many modern buildings in a town of Dulce, including two brand new looking emergency medical facilities, including a brand new high school building, a brand new elementary school building. This all in a town of less than 2,600 people. And something is there to maybe some kind of a funding is there. And I'm not just talking about natural gas or even gambling, slot machines. No,
yeah.
There's something more than that that makes Dulce a very fascinating area involving the U.S. government. No
now,
question.
Now, Anthony, in your investigation, you came across parking lots with too many cars for the building?
Yeah, so one of the other stories that I looked into was the Richard Doty story. And essentially what you're going to find from this book is that the colonel discounts all of the Tal Jason Bishop reptilian story, and there's not a single mention of any of the data that comes out of the Richard Data story. This is a completely unique and different take on Dulce, and it involves Paul Benowitz, Myrna Hansen, Phil Schneider, and it's a different perspective on Dulce. And the Los Alamos access, the LANL access points, wherein by the scientific contingent and engineering groups who operate at the Dulce facility, they take maglev shuttles back to the area of the Los Alamos Township surrounding the TOWI building. And if you look, it's a centralized area where there's more parking than there are, more than enough parking for the capacity of the people within the buildings.
And Nori and I are talking about that one time about the high school in Dulce. Seems like it's a bigger building than it needs.
That's right. If you go to Dulce today and check out the high school building, you notice that it's too large for the number of students there. In fact, the number of students at Dulce school system is very small in ratio of the number of the people over there. I was there and I didn't see hardly any students during a weekday in a Dulce Elementary School or other schools. There are some students, but the buildings are too large for the number of students.
Yeah, another thing I wanted to point out, too, was there is a long history, based on the information that the colonel provided to me, of people being abducted by the inhabitants there. The inhabitants, what we know traditionally as Greys. I mean, we're just, 40 feet away from Travis Walton, who had an experience. Arizona's not that far from Dulce. So Myrna Hansen and her 6-year-old son coming back from Texas, right up along the road here in Cimarron, with this harrowing event and retelling of this their ordeal being captured by Greys. All of this is confirmed by the colonel. All of us.
Now, the Greys, who signed this agreement with them, they wouldn't be mutilating humans.
The United States government.
I mean, was this a famous Eisenhower Edwards Air Force meeting or the Kirkland meeting? But it must have been before that.
It was before that.
Because you said 40, in 1940, you brought that date up earlier.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, it happened in the initial accord occurred in the mid-40s. The question was, there's so many reported UFO crashes within New Mexico. The colonel states that the reason why all these crashes occurred in New Mexico was a byproduct of Project Diana. Project Diana was a radar technology that we were developing that was based upon microwave technology. And this had a really, really adverse effect on the craft that the Greys used to when they came out at night, did their business.
So there's some evidence they zapped these things.
Yes, and when they realized that it worked as a deterrent to them flying around, the military at one point took an aggressive stance using the radar technology to down these craft. The most famous one that is going to come about based on the book is the crash that occurred in San Antonio, New Mexico. That was the first one that the colonel mentions.
We have an interview that we've done here that's available on our website with Chuck Wade, who's done some great research on that, and he's had that theory a long time. I've talked to Chuck over the years, and he says they're using that as a weapon. They would turn that up and zap people. It was designed that way to keep them away from Los Alamos. They're talking about the enemy, Cold
sure.
War.
Sure, sure.
And why not use it on the ETs?
Sure.
He may be right.
Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Well, it's going to be confirmed in this book, based on the colonel's testimony.
Yeah. Okay, we only have a couple of minutes. What do we need to do here? You got anything?
Well, I think I would like to wrap up by saying that, yes, we hear of Area 51. That's a household name now. And I believe personally that people like Bob Lazar had to be used in order, if this thing exists. The government is not going to say that there's a base there. The government always tries to pick a person as a conduit to bring the information that they want to bring out to the public. So the same thing with Dulce. Okay, the Kirtland Air Force Base would never have stated in the newspaper that there's a base in Dulce, in northern New Mexico. They had to choose somebody as a conduit to slowly bring it to the public. And I think that Paul Benowitz played a role in that, whether wittingly or unwittingly. I don't know, but I think that's the position of the government. The government uses people to bring out certain information gradually or whatever it is, you know. So that's my position right here.
And Anthony, your final summary.
Yeah, you know, this is a very interesting piece of testimony, and my hope is that when the data gets out there, that other people will come forth and try to corroborate this information. There has to be somebody else who is willing to come forth.
Well, certainly you can contact us at jerryjerrypippin.com and your blog. We have a link to that.
UFOhighway.com, yeah. And I want to thank Nori Ohayakawa for helping me perform research, because this is a very, very interesting subject. One other thing I'd like to point out, too, is that when this information first hit the Internet, Frank Warren of the UFOChronicles.com, he put this information out there, got onto ATS and all these other websites. I started receiving death threats about getting this information out there. The other morning, Norio and I were having coffee, and somebody photographed my car, they photographed his car, they photographed us. And then I had unmarked white vans following me from my job in downtown Sacramento to my home. And
you had a 17-hour drive. Did you see anything suspicious on the way?
There's a reason why I chose to drive in my own car from Sacramento to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I don't want to get into it, but I feel safer when I'm in control of my own faculties here. And
Okay, we're looking forward to the book. And audience, if you applaud for these people, they did a great job.
Thank you for coming.
And this has been our Dulcely Special from Angel Fire and the Paranormal Symposium. And Roberta Scott's our own location producer. Shannon Johnson is our consultant and extra person. And Jane Swartley is our web producer. Until next time, Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Cheers.